Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
The Fidget Hypothesis by Matt Wallace. It's written in response to write a story from the point of view of a witch, a pet, or a witch's familiar. The first time Fidget found the mistress dead, he got so scared that he lost one of his lives. It wouldn't be the last time she did this, but some warning would have been polite. Maybe he had four left. Cats were never really good at math. She had obviously been working on some mystical experiment that backfired badly. Fidget's bushy tail twitched and he cocked his head, staring into her open mouth. A furry paw gently bapped at her cheek once, twice, and a third time for good measure. Fidget leapt with a quick spring to the top of the work table, cluttered with the labors of the mistress. He stared down at her, thinking that she may be playing a trick on him. He meowed at her still form, irritated at her for thinking she could trick him so easily. He casually licked the paw and ran it over his face. His golden eyes narrowed, thinking, two can play at this game. His paw tapped at a glass beaker, tap, tap, tapping it closer and closer to the edge of the table. His eyes never left her, waiting to see if she'd jump up to correct his naughty behavior. It was halfway off the table by now. Usually by this time she would have rushed over to him, shooing him out of the lab, threatening to eat him if he ruined another serum. The beaker hit the floor with a crash so loud that even Fidget jumped. Still, the mistress didn't move. She was most definitely dead. But who will feed me now? Fidget's tail danced violently. While the auto feeder might still have some food in it, who knew how long it would be before it gave out? He had heard stories about cats whose owners had died. They were forced to eat their late owners, usually starting with the face. Fidget licked his chops involuntarily, looking down at the mistress's plump cheeks. But now wasn't the time to be thinking about such things. Besides, wasn't she working on something that had to do with this? He remembered her talking about her work, something about technology and magic or something. Technology is just someone else's magic, she always used to say. He liked when the mistress talked about her work, but eventually he would grow bored and knock something off her workstation to get her attention. The mistress would usually chase him out of the lab, often the only good play he'd get for most of the day. Fidget sighed, if cats could sigh, and turned in circles on the work table. He had just eaten, after all, and something of this magnitude shouldn't be decided on without a nap. He lay down, rested his chin on his furry white paws, blinked his eyes slowly as his mistress sat on the floor, and faded off to sleep. He awoke several hours later to the sound of humming, a sound he never thought he'd hear again. The fluffy cat blinked his eyes open, stretched his arched back, and saw the mistress, hard at work as if nothing had ever happened, filling the place with the scent of burning things and chemicals. It was a smell Fidget still hadn't gotten used to. He meowed curiously, as if to ask what happened. Sometimes things go wrong when you play in the lab, she replied with a shrug. Fidget began to purr, weaving his way through tubes of glass and small flames that he learned long ago to avoid. She stroked his head and the fur that puffed out about his face. I love you too, she said. Except when you break my beakers. Then I only love you sometimes. He had heard that before. He turned and shoved his poofy tail towards her face, jumped down, and went off in search of adventure. He remembered the day she brought him home, found him licking his wounds after narrowly escaping being poured into a trash compactor behind a restaurant. Fidget was sure this is where he lost his first life. He stunk and was covered in uninvited pests, skinny from malnourishment, and didn't really know how to be a cat. But he could tell from the coo in her voice that the mistress was friendly. She scooped him up, and after a rather humiliating bath that left his skinny body matted with wet hair and a round of medication from the vet, he was home. His fluffy tail shuddered involuntarily at the thought of that, or any other vet visit. Fidget sauntered through the cold floors and odd smells of the lab and up the stairs to the living area. He'd had enough of the mistress's magic for the day and decided to go do cat stuff, as she would say, that even a science witch couldn't understand. The first order of business involved climbing to the top of his cat tree to observe the front lawn. As he sat, tail neatly tucked at his side, Fidget began to think about the mistress's death. Why she was back did not concern him. She was, and that was all that needed to be said about the matter. But he even began to ponder his own existence, as cats often do, and thought about the other lives he had lost along the way. Life number two, as alluded to before, involved the laboratory. Not long after his rescue, the mistress slowly started to introduce Fidget to the laboratory in the basement. Within a handful of weeks, he started to feel quite at home in the lab and would often jump up on places that the mistress thought he shouldn't. She may have been right sometimes. After all, a cat with an extraordinarily fluffy tail should not walk casually past an open flame. Fidget's tail went up in a quick blaze, burning like a torch before he even noticed it. In fact, it was the look of abject horror on the mistress's face, her hands slapped across her open mouth, that let Fidget know something was wrong. That and the smell of burning cat hair. Fidget shot across the lab, howling like a spirit in the night, breaking most of the things he bumped into in a frantic attempt to put out the flame. The mistress tried chasing him, but trying to catch a cat on fire is like trying to hold in your last breath. It wasn't until she sprayed him with foam from the fire extinguisher that he slid to a stop. A trail of burnt foam covered the floor behind him. The mistress was furious with Fidget after that, banning him from the laboratory for over a month. It wasn't until she grew tired of his howling, heard even in the depths of the basement, that she let him back in. Fidget never jumped on that table again. Fidget shook his head at the thought of the singed tail and licked a rogue spot of misplaced fur, glaring at the white tip of his black tail, a souvenir from life's too dramatic end. It was then that he heard the promising beep of the auto feeder and the clattering clang of kibble landing in the metal feeding bowl. The fluffy cat licked his lips at the end of his feast and couldn't help but think about the end of number three, the lesson that sometimes the most delicious things should be avoided or at least not placed within the reach of a curious and hungry cat. The mistress rarely left her experiments in the living area, choosing to mostly keep work and private life separate, with the exception of Fidget, of course. But one day, the fluffy cat came upon a sweet-smelling green liquid sitting in a bowl on the countertop of the kitchen. It was still a while before feeding time, and Fidget couldn't resist. He sniffed at it tentatively. It smelled almost like the frozen milk the mistress would occasionally let him have. He cautiously tapped at the top of it with his paw. It was like his water dish. She wouldn't leave this out for me if she didn't want me to have it. His pink tongue eagerly lapped at the strange liquid. It was delicious. Fidget eagerly lapped up the rest of the treat and licked the bowl clean. The small metal bowl spun around on the counter and clattered to the ground. I should thank her with a dead thing later. It was then that the mistress hurried into the kitchen, looking this way and that, muttering things like, "Where did I put it, and how could I leave that lying around?" When she found the small bowl on the ground, she screamed Fidget's name so loud he almost fell off the counter. He meowed a mix of annoyance and confusion. "He was right here. Do your eyes not work? Fidget, where are you?" Another meow and a cock of his head. She looked in his direction, but her eyes slid right past him without seeing. He meowed again in irritation and bapped at her with his paw that he couldn't see. "Oh, no," she gasped. "Don't tell me it did that." Fidget turned on the counter, purring his thanks for the treat and demanding pets. "If you can't see me, just smell for me." He couldn't believe humans sometimes. The serum wore off a few hours later, after an exhausting game of chase and some cat vomit that became visible a few hours later. The human looked tired as she collapsed to the couch. Perhaps a nap would do them both good. Fidget snuggled up against her leg. Her hand dropped on his head. "I love you too," she said, "sometimes." Later that day, while doing the kind of business only a cat could comprehend, Fidget thought again about the rest of his lives. The end of life number 4 happened when he tried to hunt the mistress's new creation, the Robo Falcon 9000. It turned out that metal bird flesh was not really flesh at all. Robotic birds also tended to fight back more than real birds did. The mistress chased the bird around the lab, brandishing a broom, yelling, "I'll deprogram you, you. But looking back, he wasn't sure if she was saying that to the bird or him. Life 5 ended when Fidget learned that the lab lasers are not a toy. The less said about that, the better. Over the next few years, the mistress had died several other times, only to be revived again without the traumatic shock to Fidget that cost him life number 6. Lives 7 and 8 passed without the cat even knowing they were gone. He was older now, and it was harder to do the adventurous things he used to do. He found most of his days curled up on his cat tree, silently judging the world outside. If not that, then he would meow incessantly until the mistress picked him up and laid him on a cat bed on one of the tables in the lab. "You don't really fidget anymore, do you, buddy?" she asked. He let out a quick meow of agreement and closed his eyes. Fidget couldn't remember the last time he'd enjoyed eating. Water, too, seemed like something to be avoided. It had been like this for days. Every time he turned up his food, the mistress would start to cry. One day, she took him down to the lab, her steps slower than usual. She laid him in a soft bed on a table. She whispered, "It'll only sting for a moment." And he felt a pinch in his paw. She wrapped the paw in tape, a tube leading out from it. Fidget looked up at her as much as his tired head would allow. He rubbed the side of his face against her hand, then dropped his chin back to his paws, being careful to avoid the one with the tube. "I'm afraid we have to say goodbye." He looked up at her and blinked slowly. "I can't keep bringing you back. It's unfair." Fidget slow blinked his eyes at her again. "Did you love me?" he asked, knowing she couldn't hear. "I loved you all of the time." She choked around globs of tears in her eyes. "Even when you sabotaged my work, I loved you all of the time." Her face dove into her crossed arms on the table, shoulders racking with sobs. The tips of her fingers still caressed the side of his face. He purred quietly, knowing that she was being honest. Fidget heard the click of a button, and he suddenly felt sleepy. More sleepy than any cat really should feel. But it was okay. The mistress was here. He could nap soundly, knowing that he'd wake up, like just like he always did, to the one who took him in and loved him all of the time. He fell asleep to the soft feeling of her fingers caressing his face. He never woke up. Months later, the mistress would find herself working in the lab, still glancing behind her for a fluffy tail, listening for the sound of shattering beakers or for a meow that demanded an earlier dinner. She would occasionally look up at the plaster paw print she had made the day Fidget took his last nap and smile. The lab feels empty now without Chaos in a cat suit watching her every move. The Last Smile by C.C. C.W.S.C.G.S. I wake before the sun, not out of discipline. The woods simply don't allow you to sleep late. The birds start first, the jittery ones with wings like flicked paper. Then the wind follows, slipping through the pines in long, steady breaths. The forest stretches awake, and my body wakes with it, stiff in all the places age has claimed. For a moment, I lie still in my nest of branches, letting the world settle into focus. 20 years I've slept in this tree. 10 feet off the ground, in a cradle I wove myself. I climb down, careful on the last few rungs, carved by my own hands, worn smooth by my own feet. Cold moss greets my toes. The air smells of cedar and damp earth. The sky is the last thing I look at. This morning a white streak cuts across, a fresh scar still glowing, another launch, another craft that slipped out of the atmosphere before dawn, bound for whatever world they're colonizing or chasing or claiming. They rise every day now, silver needles vanishing into the dark. Somewhere, I'm sure people watch them with awe. I look up just long enough to remember I still don't care. Whatever future humanity is chasing, they can keep it. I walk over to the place I call home, a raised den of woven branches, clay-packed walls, and pine sap sealant. Inside it smells like smoke and dried herbs and cats. 7 of them today, descendants of a feral pregnant orange female that I brought with me on my journey. I named her Lyra. She's long gone, but her line remains, slipping out of the shadows to weave around my ankles. Morning, I say. I've known life with humans and life without them. At this point, I prefer the version where every smile isn't pre-programmed. Another ordinary morning, another day unseen, untouched by the world beyond the tree line. Down here among the pines, I move slowly, breathe deeply. When the branches creak just right, when the light hits the moss in that particular way, I find myself smiling too, crooked, weathered, but entirely my own. People like to tell stories about catastrophes, Armageddon, end of days. The day everything changed, the blast, the plague, the meteor. But that's not how it happened here. Nothing exploded. The world didn't end. It just smoothed itself out. Before I was born, the groundwork was already there. In the 2020s, artificial intelligence was small and eager, a polite assistant for people who still thought they were in charge. By the 2030s, machines had taken half the world's jobs, not with rebellion, but with efficiency. Governments rolled out basic income to keep people calm. Most families relaxed into it. My parents didn't. They saw what was coming, a world drifting away from effort, discomfort, and the parts of ourselves that only grow when life is challenging. Then came the chips. They started as care, not control, or that's how they sold them. 2040s, tracking implants so no child would ever be lost again. 2050s, health chips to monitor vitals, flag disease before symptoms. 2060s, cognitive boosts, perfect memory, bottomless focus. 2070s, tone regulators, smoothing harsh words before they left your mouth. 2080s, emotional governance, implants that dial down fear, anger, despair. 2090, smile sync, the final tweak, an implant that corrected your facial expressions to match the approved global standard, pleasant, calm, open, neutral. By 2100, implantation was mandatory. Who wants to be unsafe, unstable, unwell, uncompliant? By 2110, the world was peaceful, efficient, predictable, streets full of identical empty smiles. I was born in 2045, when opting out of chipping was still technically legal, though the paperwork came with threats written between the lines. My parents refused to implant me. Doctors lectured, schools hinted at intervention. They called the chips soft chains. They didn't want metal in my nervous system or an invisible hand on my moods. We held out as long as we could on the grid. There was a narrow window when I really tried to live along with them. I loved a man once. I was going to have a daughter. She didn't survive the second trimester, and neither did the relationship. Even now, I wonder if she'd lived, would I have stayed, tried harder, let myself be part of humanity a little longer? Sometimes I picture her grown, moving through these woods beside me as if she belongs here too, at the edge of the earth. Before I vanished, I lived in the seams of cities, under bridges, in abandoned stations, in camps that formed and dissolved beneath overpasses. Back when addiction and untreated illness still existed, I learned that if you mumbled to yourself and kept your eyes wild, people looked away. Drones classified you as non-threatening anomaly and rolled past. I never had a bank account, never had a chipped ID, no workplace badge, no phone, no data trail worth mining. So when my parents died and I chose to sneak deep into the Pine Barrens, nothing on any server registered my absence. The system forgot me, or simply never tracked me in the first place. Whatever is left of humanity is busy flinging itself into the stars. No nuclear winter, no alien invasion, no righteous asteroid. Just a long series of small, reasonable choices. The world didn't die. But I sometimes catch myself thinking I would have preferred the meteor. Routine keeps me alive. Refill water before noon. Kill every ember before dark. 20 years alone teaches you that even small carelessness has teeth. Last night, I was careless. I'd been mending a fence on the West Ridge after a buck tore through it. By the time I finished, the sky was already black, and my little campfire felt like company. I let it burn. When I wake, the light was wrong. Too sharp, too orange. The air is hot in my lungs. I climb down fast. A wall of flame is crawling up the ridge where my coals should have gone to sleep hours ago. One shift of wind, that's all it took. Fire races from crown to crown, turning trees I've known for decades into torches. For a heartbeat, I stand there, barefoot, in the moss, watching the forest burn. Drones will see this. Satellites. Automated suppression systems. Someone's or something's version of help is on the way. Ash drifts over my skin like gray snow. I move. Shotgun, knives, water filter, rations, rope. Three of the cats, Liberty, Solus, Red, scooped into carriers. The others bolt into the underbrush. I hope instinct keeps them smarter than I've been. After what feels like forever, I drop into a low grove and set the cats in the shade. My hands tremble. For a moment, there is only the roar of the fire. Then a new sound rises, a mechanical vibration, layered and precise. Dozens of drones streak overhead in a perfect grid. They release blue suppressant mist in even sheets. Within minutes, the blaze that should have chewed through the forest all day is a smoking scar on the ridge. Reform their pattern and sweep away toward the coast. All but one. A single drone drops out of formation, hovers in front of me. It lingers for a beat, as if thinking. Then it shoots upward and disappears. Something has seen me. I don't sleep that night. By sunrise, the forest feels wrong. Listening. Footsteps break the silence. Human footsteps. I crouch behind a fallen trunk, shotgun ready. Two figures move through the trees. Tall, clean, clothed in a light blue uniform. Their faces are ageless. Their smiles are identical, wide, placid. I haven't seen another person in 20 years. Hello, the woman says. Her voice is bright and flat at once. You can come with us. The man beside her tilts his head at the exact same angle. We'll take you to safety. New York City is secure. You'll be welcomed. They don't ask if I'm hurt or hungry. They just stand there smiling and gesture toward a sleek silver craft hovering between the pines. I'm fine where I am, thank you, I say. The woman's smile doesn't change. You have been identified as unimplanted, she replies. The first we've encountered in over a decade. Remaining here is not an option. We are here to help you and bring you to safety. They step toward me together, synchronized. My finger squeezes the trigger. The blast cracks the air. The man drops, blood forming from the center of his forehead, his body hitting the forest floor with finality. The woman's smile flickers, then resets. She doesn't scream, doesn't run, doesn't blink, doesn't look to revive her partner or call for help. She advances, arms extended in a mock gentle reach. I fire again, once, twice, three times. Her chest fractures, spraying shards of synthetic bone and wiring. She takes another step before her legs fold, dropping her face first beside the man. Her smile stays printed on her ruined mouth. Human and machine lie side by side in the pine needles. Is this it? I whisper to nobody. Hours crawl by. No more footsteps, no more drones. I bury the bodies in shallow graves and wipe my hands on the dirt. What does a civilization that hasn't seen a murder in decades do with the first murderer it's found? I don't care to find out. Part of me believes maybe that's the end of it. Systems glitch. Signals fail. I could still vanish deeper in. But at dusk, the ground starts to shake. Birds explode out of the trees and panic swarms. Something massive lowers through the canopy. A circular hut, wider than my whole camp. Jointed arms unfolding like an insect. Pale lights sweeping like forest in slow arcs. I run. An arm snaps out with shocking speed, clamps around my waist and lifts me off my feet. I scream and shove the cat carriers away. They tumble open, then vanish into brush. Run, I shout uselessly. I'm pulled into a hanging glass pod, barely wider than my shoulders. The hatch seals with a soft hiss. I slam my fists into the transparent wall until my knuckles split. The pod doesn't so much as shiver. Below, my forest shrinks to a dark patchwork. We rise over miles of pine before the green gives way to shining grids. solar fields, automated farms, irrigation channels glowing faint blue, highways curve across the landscape empty of cars. Newark Airport appears on the horizon, but it isn't an airport anymore. The runways are still there, but nothing lands on them. Instead, a forest of launch spires rises from the old tarmac, thin, gleaming towers lined in perfect rows. As we pass overhead, one of them activates. A craft shoots upward so fast, the air barely ripples, a silver needle flicking into the sky and vanishing as if erased. Another waits. Another lifts. They launch in quiet succession, disappearing into the upper atmosphere without flame, without roar, without return. I scan the horizon for inbound traffic, contrails, anything coming home. There's nothing, only departures. And I find myself thinking, where are they going? And why does nothing ever come back? We leave the launch fields behind as the machine carries me east. Water unfurls beneath us, the dark sheet of the Hudson, and then, rising from it like a memory carved into bedrock, she appears, the Statue of Liberty. But she is not the statue I remember. The stone-green copper is gone, replaced by some reflective alloy that catches the sun and throws it outward in blinding arcs. The torch blazes with a concentrated beam of light, white, impossibly bright. It pulses every few seconds, a signal meant not for ships on water, but for eyes in orbit. A lighthouse for off-world colonies? A reminder of where humanity began? Or a warning? As we pass her shoulder, the beam sweeps across the pod, bleaching the world to white before fading again. I'm both inspired and terrified. Then New York City rises. Half the skyline is gone, replaced by curving towers grown from seamless metal like the bones of some enormous creature. The streets below are immaculate, eerily quiet. No rush, no chaos. Silver trams glide along invisible tracks. People move in coordinated flows on the sidewalks, heads straight, shoulders relaxed, all of them wearing the same soft, placid smile. Their steps match in rhythm, as if synced to a pulse I cannot hear. Workers stand at kiosks with identical expressions. From above, the whole city looks choreographed, like a single organism, smiling in unity. The pod tilts, angling toward a tower whose upper floors bloom open like a metal flower. Panels unfurl, revealing a landing nest bathed in pale blue light. The machine descends. Mechanical arms reach out. Two humanoids wait. Their smiles are identical to the ones I shot in the woods. Rose, one says, my name landing wrong in its mouth. You're safe now. The rooftop tilts. The sky smears into violet streaks. The last thing I see is that perfect empty smile leaning closer. Then the world shuts off. When I wake, the world is white. White walls, white light, white coats, and the smiles. Every one of them, identical. My vision swims, still blurred at the edges from whatever they injected into me. Two technicians stand at my bedside, hands folded, smiles fixed. When they see my eyes open, they lean in with rehearsed relief. You're safe now, one murmurs. Where am I? My throat is raw. What city is this? Who brought me here? They exchange a glance, perfect mirroring, like two screens refreshing at the same time. You are in a stabilization facility, the woman says. Your well-being is our priority. They guide me out of the bed before I can resist. their hands light but firm on my elbows. I try to pull back. They don't tighten, they simply adjust, redirecting my body with the ease of people trained not to allow struggle. "Why am I here?" I ask. "What do you want from me?" Neither looks at me. They just smile. "You were living in a condition of unmanaged emotion," the man answers. "We are here to correct that." They lead me down a corridor so bright it hurts, into a chamber shaped like a perfect circle. No corners to hide in, no shadows to disappear into. A single reclined chair waits in the center, gleaming under the lights. I dig my heels into the floor. "I'm not sitting in that." They continue smiling. "You will be comfortable," the woman assures me. "Correction is painless." "I don't want correction." This time they do look at me, both at once, with the same mild curiosity one gives an unusual insect. "Wanting is an outdated cognitive framework," the man says gently. "It causes suffering." Before I can move, they guide me into the chair with terrifying softness and begin fastening the restraints. Wrists, ankles, forehead brace. My heart pounds. "What happened to choice?" I whispered. The woman smooths a strap across my arm as if tucking in a child. Preference was the first casualty of peace. I swallow against the rising panic. If I refuse this, if I don't want to live this way, just kill me or let me end my own existence. "Homicide is illegal," the man says, tone steady and warm. "Death is unnecessary. You will feel joy." They say it like comfort. And in that moment, strapped, helpless, surrounded by flawless empty faces, I understand with a clarity that aches. I am the last person alive who remembers what a real smile feels like. Crooked, weathered, chosen. A robotic arm unfolds from the ceiling, descending toward the base of my skull. A thin silver needle meant to pierce the brainstem. I turn my head toward the nearest technician, a young woman with soft brown hair and dimples carved in exactly the right places, and eyes that have never held a single feeling of her own. And I give her a smile, my human smile. Her synthetic grin falters. For a heartbeat, something flickers across her face. Confusion, maybe fear. Then the needle slips into the base of my skull. A burst of white tears cross my vision. The last true human smile disappears from the earth. They release me into society the next day. I have an apartment, a clean, soft-lit cube with a window that displays whatever sky the system chooses, and a cleaning drone that zips around my feet. Each morning, a floating panel wakes and displays my assignment. Park maintenance, 0800 hours. Sweep paths, trim shrubs. I do as instructed with calm efficiency. Everyone does. I walk the park's smooth paths with the same perfect expression worn by every passerby. Children, elders, workers, maintenance machines. We all smile all the time. At night, I dream of pine needles and cold moss, of branches creaking under my weight, of cats purring against my ankles, of the parents I lost, of the daughter I never met, of my own face lifting in a crooked grin no one programmed. When I wake, I'm always turned toward the city's edge, where the trees begin, dark, still, patient. And beneath the curated joy, beneath the obedient muscles and layered directives, something in me is still mine. Maybe all those years unchipped made my mind harder to overwrite. Maybe one technician hesitated. Maybe the system simply glitched. Whatever the reason, a welcome uneasiness, an endless spark, lives on inside me, faint stubborn, waiting for wind. A forest, waiting for a survivor to return. Maybe someday I'll follow that pull. Maybe someday, even in a world that forbids it, I'll smile genuinely again. Final broadcast by Alex Twyman. Written in response to Write a Story About Goodbyes Without Using the Word Goodbye, Bye, or Farewell. Mission time, plus 23 hours since impact. Personal recorder, manual activation. Mission specialist, Dr. Adrian Hale. The ship groaned. It made a long, dragging sound like nails on a chalkboard. Okay, focus. Life support is sitting at 32%, dropping steadily. I sealed off Module C, but the breach must be deeper in the hull. Still losing pressure. No comms, no thrusters, no rotation control. The gyros are offline. We're drifting. I'm running the numbers, but, well, there aren't many numbers left to run. I tried the long-range transmitter 3 times. First attempt, I only got static, then got nothing at all. On the 3rd try, the panel sparked and the entire array shut down completely. Great. The backup power cell's blown, and I don't have the tools to replace it, even if I did have the oxygen to spare. I don't know why I'm recording this. Maybe because I hate the silence. Maybe because I like the sound of my own voice. Maybe because I can't give up. Not yet. I'll keep at it in any case. The file is recoverable sometime in the future. Status report. Structural integrity is currently unstable. Hull fracture located in Sector 4B. Oxygen down to 31 minutes. Crew, just me. Unfortunately, Naomi and Marcus didn't make it. Naomi was closest. The decompression pulled her into the bulkhead before I could even hit the lockdown. Marcus tried to seal the secondary hatch, but the blast threw him into the support beam. I dragged him in here with me, but it was too late. He was already gone. I keep replaying the way Marcus looked at me, like he thought I could fix any of this, as if I had more control than I did. I'm sorry. I wish I could have done more. I wish I could tell their families. I tried my best to do something, tried my best to save them. At least they didn't have to suffer. Miguel, Sophie, I know this probably won't reach you in time. The antenna's fried, and there's 1/2 a kilometer of metal between me and the dark void waiting outside, but I'll try anyway. You're going to hear a lot from me very soon. Entry 2. I tightened the seal around Module C again, but the pressure hasn't changed. Still, doing something feels better than doing nothing. I rationed the last of the water, enough for maybe a day if I'm careful. The temperature dropped another 2 degrees. I can see my breath now. It's kind of pretty in a weird sort of way. I ran a systems check out of habit. I don't know why. Maybe because I've done it every morning for the past 6 months. Wake up, stretch, check the gauges, log the readings, eat, work out, run more tests, and go to bed. I keep thinking about Sunday mornings, about our Sunday mornings, our pancakes that tasted like charcoal. Miguel swatting the smoke away with a dish towel. Sophie sitting on the counter swinging her feet, announcing that Dad burned them on purpose because he liked the texture of the charred bits. God, she laughed so hard that day, that little hiccup laugh she gets when she's trying to breathe. I don't know why I'm saying all of this. I started out meaning to give another status update, but habits die out when you're alone. Anyways, I'll check the stabilizers next. Entry 03. The stabilizers are a lost cause. Everything I touch either sparks or fails. I'm trying to be careful, but the suit wasn't designed for this kind of hard labor. My hands feel clunky, heavy. I could list the failures again, but I think I'm done. Done pretending these logs are for mission control. So, Miguel, if you ever hear this, if someone recovers this recording and somehow gets it to you, just listen. I'm sorry. I can't help but think about you. Think about the last time I saw you. You standing in the doorway, arms crossed over your chest, trying to talk me out of it. Sophie passed out on the couch because she insisted on waiting up to give me the bracelet she had made herself. I remember. You asked me to promise I'd come home, and I made up some bad joke about probabilities and mission risks. You rolled your eyes at me, but the look on your face, I should have said something else, something different. The temperature dropped again. I should check the heaters before the cold eats the rest of the power. Entry 4. The heaters are barely holding. I can feel the cold creeping into my suit now. It settles into the joints first, then the fingers, makes everything slower. I wasn't planning to record again so soon, but I've been thinking about you, Soph. You probably grew an inch taller since I left. You always shot up like a weed when I wasn't looking. I bet you've already memorized 3 new chess openings, too. The aggressive ones, no doubt. You always liked the dramatic moves. Queen sacrifices, knight takes. I pretended to let you win the last time we played, but you didn't need the help at all. You're better than me now. I hope you know that. You once asked me if astronauts ever feel scared. I believe you were 7 at the time. You had this tiny blue flashlight on, and you kept shining it in my face like I was a person brought in for questioning. I told you the truth. Only before something important happens. Sometimes I think about that, about what I meant by it. I wish I could show you this view right now. Earth drifts slow past the viewport, blue, green, and white. You'd draw it perfectly. You always were great with colors. Entry 5. The pressure dropped again. I heard it this time, a soft hiss behind one of the panels, like the station exhaling a deep breath. I tried sealing it, but the patch kit's empty and my hands, well, they just don't feel like cooperating anymore. I should make this one short. I've been thinking not about the numbers of the repairs or the odds that I'll survive. I've been thinking about all the things I meant to say when I still had the chance. Like how I'm proud of you, Soph, for how curious you've become, how brave you've grown to be, how you never pretended to hide your feelings. Sometimes I wish I had learned from you years ago. And Miguel, I owe you the truth. You asked me once why I volunteered for this mission, why I'd leave home right after promising I'd stay. I fed you some bull, lying about duty and opportunity and scientific achievement. But the truth is simpler than you might think. I wanted to feel useful again. Wanted to prove I still had value out here. Prove that I wasn't aging out, that I wasn't slowing down. I think I was scared of becoming someone who needed more than he offered. When I left Earth, I told myself I'd make it up to you both when I got back. That I'd take you camping again, even though I forgot the tent poles the last time we went. That I'd be there for Sophie's school play, that I'd fix the leaky faucet under the sink like I promised. But I kept putting it off. The panel hissed again. It's getting louder. I'm going to close my eyes now, just for a minute. Entry 6. I didn't mean to sleep. I must have drifted off sitting against the bulkhead. The suit alarm awoke me. Oxygen dipped below 20%. I should feel panicked about that, but strangely, I don't. There's a stillness settling over the ship now. A gentle hush, the kind you only hear in hospitals late at night or in the woods right before it snows. It doesn't feel hostile anymore, just calm. Earth passed through the viewpoint again while I was out, a thin crescent of light on the edge, soft blue fading into shadow. I don't know if it's turning or if I am. Hard to tell the difference when you're floating. I'm not going to pretend I have more fixes left in me. I barely have the strength to lift my arms. Even the cold feels distant now. I've been replaying moments in my head. Sophie drawing stars on the fogged kitchen window. Miguel humming when he chopped vegetables. The sound of our old porch steps creaking when the three of us sat out there after dinner, watching the fireflies blink in and out of existence. I didn't realize how much I miss it, the feeling of it. I think I've stopped fighting the idea that I might not ever see either of you again. But I'm not scared. Not anymore. Entry 7. I don't think I have much time left. The suit alarm keeps going off, but it's quieter now, or maybe I am. I keep reaching up to shut it off and missing the button by a few inches. My hands feel like they're wrapped in wet cement. I don't want to talk about the systems anymore, or the ship, or the cold. I want to talk about you. Miguel, there are so many things I wish I had said to you. You deserved someone who could say them easily, without stumbling over every word like it was some kind of math equation. But you stayed with me anyway. You stayed, and you carried more than your share of the weight. I hope you know how deeply I loved you for that. Still do. Soph, my little star, I can almost see you rolling your eyes at me for calling you that. You're probably too old for it now, too grown up. I wish I could have seen all of it. All of it. You winning the next chess tournament, you learning how to braid your own hair, you discovering your next favorite song. Listen, the two of you. You made my life bigger than any universe could hold. You made it warm and full and... Hold on, I need a second. The air's thin. Hard to think straight, hard to breathe. I just want you to know, both of you, that you were the best parts of me. Every single one. And if I had one more morning, one more burned pan, one more hiccup laugh, I'd be fine. End of transmission.